Right. Let's dive into this case, Colgrove v. Green,
Yeah.
from 1946. It's really the case that kicks off all these debates about gerrymandering, and we're going to kind of trace how that idea, one person, one vote, how that went from this kind of radical thought to something that's, at the heart of fair elections. And, Colgrove was a loss,
Yeah.
right? But it kind of planted the seeds for that change to happen. So we've got a lot to work with, court opinions and all kinds of analysis of this thing.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating case, really. Throws open the doors to the courthouse, and we kind of have to ask, like, should the courts be messing around with how we vote, or is that, strictly for the politicians to deal with?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, okay, imagine it's 1946 in Illinois, right? Think about everything that happened to the US between like 1901 and then. You've
Yeah.
got industrialization, you've got people moving to cities, you've got two world wars, right? Now imagine Illinois and like their voting districts are just stuck in 1901. One district's got almost 1 million people, another one's barely over 100,000. I mean, somebody's vote is basically meaningless compared to somebody else just because of where they live, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly what this guy, Kenneth W. Colgrove, he was a political scientist, and that's what he was so angry about. He was like, this is a violation of the Constitution, straight up. He pointed to Article One, how Congress is set up, and then, of course, the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. It's like, my vote should count just as much as anyone else's. It seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, that seems fair. So did the Supreme Court, did they agree with him? I mean, what happened?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. So it's a 4-3 decision, and they basically said, nope, not our problem.
Wow.
They pulled out this thing called the political question doctrine. It's like, if you and your neighbor are fighting over whose tree is shading whose garden, that's for you two to work out, right?
Right.
But like, if the government wants to just come in and bulldoze your whole block without asking anybody, well, that's maybe when the courts should step in.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court in Colgrove, they thought redistricting, it was more like the tree dispute, just a squabble between neighbors.
But I mean, wait a minute. If the courts are supposed to, be there to protect our rights, I mean,
Yeah.
voting's pretty fundamental, right? Why would they just leave it up to the politicians
Yeah.
to decide how it all works, especially when things are so unbalanced? Oh, that seems kind of risky.
You're right. And this guy, Justice Frankfurter, he wrote the main opinion in the case. And he was, he really believed in this idea of judicial restraint. Like, the courts shouldn't be jumping into these political battles unless it's absolutely like the last resort, And he had this famous warning. He's like, getting involved in redistricting, that's like walking into a political thicket.
A political thing. I love that.
Yeah.
What exactly did he, I mean, what did he mean by that? And why was that, I mean, was that really enough to like win the day?
Well, yeah, he thought it was just too messy, like way too complicated for judges to be, meddling in. It's like you're asking them to, I don't know, untangle this giant knot of political interests, and there's no like easy answer, There's no right or wrong.
So they were basically worried about like overstepping their boundary.
Right.
Got it, got it. Okay, so what about the other justices? Did they all agree with Frankfurter, or was there some pushback?
No, not entirely. I mean, Justice Rutledge, he agreed that the case should be dismissed, but for different reasons. He was worried about the practical side of things. I mean, think about it. 1946 election, it was right around the corner. He thought, if they jump in now, it's just going to cause chaos. It might actually disenfranchise even more voters. It's like, trying to fix a plane engine while it's still in the air.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So Frankfurt is like, stay out of politics. Rutledge is like, this is a logistical nightmare. But okay, what about the justices on the other side? I mean, there had to be some who saw this as, like a clear violation of voting rights.
Absolutely. And you're totally right. Justice Black, he wrote this really blistering dissent. It was really fiery. And in a lot of ways, it laid the groundwork for later wins in voting rights cases, right? He argued that voting is a fundamental right, just like property rights are, and that the courts have this duty to protect it, not, shy away from it.
Yeah, I mean, he's calling them out for being inconsistent, right?
Yeah,
It's like
yeah.
protecting property, fine, but protecting the right to like choose our leaders, suddenly they're hands off.
Exactly. And his focus on voting as a fundamental right, just like property rights, that became a like a cornerstone of these later cases that successfully challenged, unequal representation. So Colgrove, Yeah, they lost that one. But Black's Descent, it was like this powerful seed that would eventually, you know, grow into something much bigger.
Yeah, and he was right. I mean, Black's Descent, it really did lay the groundwork. It took some time, but, you know, that seed finally sprouted. So 1962, Baker v. Carr, and they're, you know, dealing with a similar issue, unequal representation, this time in Tennessee. And the Supreme Court, you know what? They decide they can't just sit this one out.
So Baker v. Carr is like a total turning point, right?
Yeah.
What changed their minds? I mean, what made them finally decide to wade into that political thicket that Frankfurter was, you know, so worried about? Well, they finally recognize that, you know what? Unequal representation, this is a legal issue. This is something that the courts can and should address, you know? It's like they finally looked at that giant tangled knot that Frankfurter was so afraid of, and they said, you know what? We can't just ignore this. We've got to try to untangle it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so they decide to step in, but did they have any, like, any plan, I mean, any guidelines for how to actually fix these messed up districts? Or was it still kind of like the Wild West of redistricting?
Well, that's where the famous one person, one vote principle, that's where that comes in, right? Baker v. Carr kind of opened the door. And then you've got cases like Reynolds v. Sims in 64 that, you know, really they kicked that door wide open and they made it clear. It's like, look, voting districts, they need to be as equal in population as possible.
I mean, that's a huge, huge change.
Right.
From like not our problem to here's a rule, follow it.
Yeah.
So what actually happened after that? Yeah. I mean, did states really start like redrawing their maps and making things fairer?
Oh, absolutely. Baker v. Carr, I mean, that set off like this tidal wave of redistricting lawsuits all across the country. I mean, states had no choice. They had to redraw their maps. And, you know, urban areas which had been systematically underrepresented, I mean, all of a sudden, they had this much stronger voice in government. You know, it was a huge win for voting rights.
It's amazing how one case can, like, totally change the political landscape, right?
Okay.
But hold on a second. If Baker v. Carr, like, solved the problem of unequal districts, then why are we still fighting about gerrymandering today? I mean, didn't we, like, slay that beast back in the 60s? What's going on?
Well, not quite. See, Baker v. Carr, that tackled what we call malapportionment, right? So that's districts with, like, wildly different populations. But it didn't get rid of this problem of partisan gerrymandering, you know, where districts are drawn specifically to benefit one party over another. Think of it this way. Baker v. Carr made sure that everybody got a slice of the pie, right? But it didn't stop politicians from trying to, like, rig how those slices were cut up in the first place.
Oh, okay. So we took care of one kind of, like, unfair districting, but then another one just popped up in its place. It's like a game of whack-a-mole or something. So where does Colgrove fit into all of this? You know, that case from way back in 46. Is it just a dusty old relic at this point? Or does it still, you know, have any relevance today?
Well, you might not believe this, but the ghost of Colgrove, it's still kind of haunting these modern legal fights about gerrymandering. I mean, even though it was overturned, those arguments about judicial restraint and, you know, that whole political question doctrine, they're still around.
Okay, I need like a concrete example. I mean, how does a case about like population differences in 1940s Illinois, I mean, how does that affect cases today?
Yeah.
Especially when we're talking about, you know, a different kind of gerrymandering. Help me out here.
All right, so fast forward to 2019. The case is Rucho v. Common Cause. This one was about extreme partisan gerrymandering, North Carolina and Maryland. And guess what? The Supreme Court, they basically said, and they cited Colgrove, they basically said, partisan gerrymandering, not a legal issue. Go talk to your politicians.
Are you serious? After all that progress we made with Baker and, you know, one person, one vote and all that, they're taking us back to the political thicket. What was their reasoning this time?
Well, the majority on the court, which was, you know, more conservative, their argument was basically, look, there's no clear standard for measuring when partisan gerrymandering like goes too far. You know, they basically said we don't have a ruler to measure fairness in this situation, so we're staying out of it.
So we're back to that same tension between, you know, protecting voting rights on the one hand and worrying about the courts, you know, overreaching on the other. It's like Colgrove has become this symbol of judicial restraint, right? This idea that judges should just keep their hands off politics.
Mm.
Even when we're talking about, you know, fundamental rights being at stake.
And that's the heart of the debate, right? I mean, when do we say, okay, the political process, this is broken down, we need the courts to step in, be the referee here? When does the system need a shakeup to make sure that everybody's voice is actually being heard?
Well, this is definitely making my head spin a little bit. It's kind of crazy how these cases from like decades ago, they still have this massive impact on our democracy. And today, it's true what they say. The past isn't really past. It's always there shaping our present and our future.
And that's exactly why it's so important to understand these cases, you know, the arguments, the context, the ripple effects. I mean, only then can we really participate in this ongoing conversation about, you know, how to create a more just and equitable society.
So, okay, let's do a quick recap, right? We started with Colgrove v. Green, where the court basically punts, right? Redistricting, too messy, not our job.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to Baker v. Carr, and they do a 180. Hold on. Unequal voting power? Yeah, we can fix that. One person, one vote. That's the new rule. Everybody follow it. But then, you know, Rucho v. Common Cause throws us right back into that political thicket, right?
Yeah.
Partisan gerrymandering, off limits, courts can't touch it. I mean, what a wild ride, right?
You got that right. It's definitely a winding road, you know, and that's law, right? It's always evolving. Every case builds on what came before. And even the cases that get overturned, they can still have this huge impact on how we think about these issues.
Okay, but this leaves us with a pretty big question, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
if the Supreme Court is basically saying, look, partisan gerrymandering, free for all, knock yourselves out. I mean, what options do voters even have? Are we just stuck with these unfair districts that basically make a mockery of fair elections? I mean, what can we do?
Well, that's where things get, I think, kind of interesting and honestly, maybe a little hopeful, you know, because even though Rucho was a setback, right, for folks who wanted the courts to step in, it didn't kill the fight against gerrymandering. In fact, you could say it's kind of sparked this whole new wave of activism and reform.
Okay, give me some examples. What are people actually doing to fight back? I mean, especially if the courts aren't, you know, offering much protection.
Well, we're seeing like the surge in these grassroots movements, right, that are pushing for these independent redistricting commissions. And the whole idea is like, let's take the power to draw these district lines. Let's take it away from partisan legislatures and let's give it to, you know, these independent nonpartisan bodies.
So basically kick the politicians out of the map making business, right?
Correctly.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Where are we seeing, you know, these reforms actually happening? Where are they taking root?
We've got states like Michigan and Colorado, Arizona, they've all adopted these independent commissions. And they've actually, you know, they've had some real success, you know, creating fairer, more competitive districts. And a lot of other states are, you know, they're looking at this really seriously. They're thinking about doing similar reforms.
That's good to hear. I mean, at least it shows that, you know, even when the courts kind of step back, the fight for fair representation, it doesn't just need to disappear, right? People are still working on this. But how do we know? I mean, how do we know that these commissions, that they're really, truly nonpartisan, right? I mean, couldn't this just become another way for special interests to like, you know, kind of work behind the scenes and get what they want?
No, you're right. It's a valid point. And it's something these commissions have to be like super careful about, right? Transparency. I think that's really the key. You know, having these crystal clear rules about who can serve on these commissions, how they're selected, and making sure all their discussions are, you know, totally open to the public. That helps build trust, right? And it prevents these kind of shady backroom deals from happening.
Yeah, transparency and accountability. Those are the magic words. It's fascinating, you know. We see how this whole issue, it's moved from like the courts to the states, and now you've got citizens, you know, they're taking this much more active role in shaping their own democracy.
Right. It's like this reminder that voting rights, they're never just, you know, guaranteed. We've got to stay informed. We got to be engaged. We got to speak up if we want our democracy to actually reflect the will of the people.
Yeah. That's a great point. What was started as a deep dive into, you know, one Supreme Court case, it's turned into this epic journey through the whole fight for fair representation, right?
Right.
I mean, we started in that political thicket of Colgrove, went through the whole, you know, one person, one vote revolution. And now we're talking about the rise of these citizen commissions. I mean, it's been quite a ride.
It has. And for me, I think the big takeaway is just that voting rights, they're precious. But they're always under pressure. We can't afford to be complacent, right? Mm. We've got to understand these issues. We've got to get involved, and we got to demand a system that truly represents all of us.
Perfect. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah.
It's a call to action, right?
Yeah.
For all of us to be active participants in shaping the future of our democracy. So thanks for joining us on this deep dive. It's been really eye-opening, and I know I'm going to be, thinking about these cases, these struggles long after we sign off.